it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. From Trump tweeting about how low unemployment is to patting himself on the back for a roaring stock market, we are bombarded daily with news about how great, quote, our economy is doing. So how can the economy be doing well, but so many American workers are barely getting by? Moreover, many Americans are having to work a variety of jobs in order to put food on the table and pay their rent, as the cost of living continues to climb while wages stay stagnant. As the saying goes, someone's getting rich, but it sure isn't me. 10 years after the Great Recession, the gap between rich and poor has grown even wider, while wealth has accumulated into fewer and fewer hands. Meanwhile, on the horizon, automation seeks to amplify this process, while at the same time, the elites are signaling a push to cut basic programs for the poor, the elderly, and the infirm. As both tech capital and gentrification rearranges the world around us, pushing millions into the margins while working us harder and longer for less and less money, we find our lives becoming more and more precarious. In this context, we need to find ways of analyzing and understanding the networks of power, energy, and capital in ways that benefit our struggles on the ground. That's why in this episode, we caught up with two people involved in Global Supply Chain's research blog, which works to map the strengths and weaknesses of modern capitalism and looks at ways in which working class people could possibly take action at choke points, leveraging the maximum amount of power in the struggles we see across the world today. Thanks for listening. Let's get into it. You all just want to introduce yourselves and the kind of work that you're doing?
Sure. I'm just going to go by the name Huli. So we work together just to, you know, study. We like to just study the world around us, right? And what it means in terms of the balance of class power. We're both, I'll let my comrade speak for himself, but, you know, we both consider ourselves militant workers against work. Uh-huh. So I'll just pass it over to you.
Yeah, I go by Hieronymus, and you know, part of the same project. And again, we're working class militants who maybe live by the adage, fight or be slaves.
And we're based here in the Bay Area.
You just want to say a little bit about the project and just kind of general what it is exactly?
Well, it has its roots going back to an action at the Port of Oakland. And when the Gulf War started in 2003, we tried to go block the port. And we learned that we didn't know much about the port, so we started studying it. And by the time Occupy happened, we were putting out packets of information, like an analysis of the port's role in global capitalism. And then we started a study group in about 2000, right after Occupy, about 2012, that's kind of gone on and off since then. And we just study global production, logistics, worker struggles within those industries, and ways that we could be effective to build worker-to-worker networks towards solidarity following the supply chain, including, you know, across oceans and across borders and to different continents.
This interview is going to be kind of have two parts. It's going to be kind of a general conversation about the current state of the economy and the different factors and players involved in that. And then we're going to get into talking exactly about your project and kind of that theory of global supply chains. So to start off the conversation, the broad strokes, what happened under the Obama administration in terms of massive wealth being moved out of the hands of the working class and the poor into the wealthy. You know, during Obama's administration, we were told over and over again that, you know, we had made it out of the crisis. But exactly how, you know, what happened economically under Obama?
To answer that question, I kind of got to go back a little. And I've also got to state that capitalism is a system that's prone to crisis, and it's just recurring crises. And this time it was after, you know, he came in after the housing boom had collapsed. And he was the perfect person because he was the first black president. He was a Democrat. And what he had to really do was save capitalism. And as the ruling class does in every crisis is they attack the working class. And what Obama did is he just did austerity. He got them through the crisis. He had that TARP bailout of trillions of dollars to the banks with just some tokens, some crumbs to people who'd been foreclosed. But basically, he saved capitalism. And he kind of got away with it. And but I think, what we, you know, putting it in the historical context is, you know, we're in this neoliberal period, and perhaps Obama's rule was the end of that period and Trump's is the beginning of something that could be different. But if you remember, like, what Obama did is he was preaching this idea of we all got to share the pain to get through the crisis. But, you know, the banks and the corporate elites got bailed out, and the pain that was inflicted upon the working class hasn't gone away. And we could even take examples like the auto industry, as he bailed them out. But then the condition was they had to cut workers' wages almost in half and junk a lot of their benefits. So I would just say what Obama did was just age-old class wars. He saved capitalism. He imposed the costs more and more on the working class, and perhaps brought the end of a phase of capital that we had kind of called neoliberalism, or whatever we call the more free trade version. And now we're facing something that's probably going to be more restrictive.
Going on to the next question, many people would point to unemployment being down currently and the fact that it is, quote, easy to get a job in many instances, yet more and more people are finding it harder and harder to make ends meet. What has changed in the economy to create this reality? Why are we so broke yet able to work so much? How can cities continue when none of the service workers can afford to live in them? I mean, we're seeing that with gentrification now, where more and more people are working in, you know, they're working several jobs in kind of this grain sector. And we're going to talk about the gig economy in a little bit, but especially with the inability of people to really exist in these big cities. I mean, what has happened economically where unemployment is down yet people are so strapped?
Yeah, I mean, so one thing I want to point to is that, you know, the figures on unemployment or on the jobless rate are very geographically specific. So, for example, there's going to be a huge difference between the Bay Area, where in sort of every corner of the Bay Area, the unemployment rate, for what it's worth, is, you know, hovers at, you know, really historic lows, you know, around 3 or under 3%, versus, for example, you know, 150, 200 miles east of where we're sitting right now, that where things could be like drastically different. So it's very geographically specific. But the interesting thing to us is that generally, or the conventional wisdom is that when unemployment goes down, the capitalists get worried, because what that indicates to the capitalists is that there's, you know, that there's a that, you know, there's a tightened labor market, which by just definitely gives workers more bargaining power, so to speak. And so there's a tendency to really want to avoid low unemployment rates because of that potential dynamic. So part of the reason, part of the thing that we find interesting to think about and that we want to understand more is that, given that sort of structural, you know, imperative, I guess, why aren't we seeing more upward pressure on wages and more pressure on bettering conditions, the conditions of daily life, right? Mm-hmm. And why are we seeing less of that than the numbers might indicate, or at least from the capitalist perspective, their worries might indicate we could expect, right? So that's one of the things that we want to think about, and we really encourage other people to think about, and also to look at where it is happening and what we can learn from that, which of course we, you know, we'll get into more discussion about that later on in this conversation, we hope. But, right. But yeah, I mean, so from, so, you know, we, you know, lately have been, you know, really interested in what's happening in the Bay Area economy, because, you know, it's all around us where we live. But what we started to see accelerating around us, especially within the last, say, year or so, is this proliferation of help wanted signs on windows, which, you know, on shop windows, restaurant windows, et cetera, like everywhere we go, which is, I can say with certainty, having grown up in the Bay Area, that this is something I've never seen it like this before. And so that's just sort of piqued our curiosity about what's going on. And so, you know, and what does that mean in terms of the potential for class war, right? Because, you know, from the way we look at it, it seems that if there's a shortage of us to do their work, then we have, the balance of power has shifted somewhat in an advantageous direction for us as workers. So what can we, start to think about, in order to maybe start to see those kinds of, us starting to harness that power. But, you know, it's also true that what's contributing to that shortage is that the cost of living has exploded, right? And wages have remained relatively stagnant, although in some places, like, for example, in San Francisco, where we've seen the minimum wage go up, it's on its way up to $15 an hour. But yeah.
It's going to do wonders.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. But anyway, you know, so wages have remained relatively stagnant, and the cost of living has exploded. And so workers who can't meet that cost of living are, as people are aware, being pushed further and further outside of the, you know, the urban core. And there's a tipping point where, you know, how much time are you going to spend and expense are you going to spend commuting for what type of wage, right? So, right. So that's, you know, there's this just economic, you know, sort of rational economic kind of calculation that workers will do. You know, if I'm going to spend 4 hours a day in my car, I got to be getting better than, you know, $12, $13, $15 an hour, right? So, so that is most certainly what's going on, part of this dynamic. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I have some specific examples, and they're pretty glaring. One is in Half Moon Bay, which is in the next county south of San Francisco. It's in San Mateo County. Mm-hmm. I saw a Burger King, and the Burger King had a big banner on the side of it, and it said, now hiring for $12 an hour. Huh. Well, San Mateo County has the base minimum wage of the state of California, which right now is $10 an hour. So I thought, that's kind of amazing, $2 an hour over the minimum wage. I went back the next week, just happened to be driving by, and they raised it to $13 an hour. They taped in a correction onto their banner, and they're now paying $3 over the minimum wage,
which is pretty
remarkable. But another example that happened just a couple days ago on Market Street in the heart of the financial district in San Francisco, I was walking by a See's candy store, and I saw a sign in the window that said they're hiring a new clerk for $18.02 an hour, and it includes benefits and all the bullshit about possible promotions and a flexible schedule and employee discounts, you know, whatever. But right now, the minimum wage, it hasn't gone up yet. It goes up on July 1st in San Francisco. Right now, the minimum wage is $14 an hour. So that's $4 over the minimum wage. So this is really these stark indications of how severe the labor shortage is. And as my comrade pointed out, if you walk through the commercial districts of San Francisco, you can't go down a popular one without seeing like every third or every other sign with the help wanted sign, even some on butcher paper scrawled in marker, that just look almost desperate. that there is this massive labor shortage in the Bay Area, and not only the greater Bay Area, but all through Northern California.
Yeah, that, I also wanted to add something, you know, so a lot of, we've really started to study this a little bit more, and some of what we're experiencing is admittedly kind of anecdotal, but we're also hearing from workers in the service industry talking about being able to like walk off your job and find another job, you know, down the street a day or two later, right?
Right.
So that's a very marked contrast to prior, you know, times that we've lived through where the fear of losing your job was such a disciplining factor in our lives that we find it very interesting to see that start to flip around. And we think there's a lot of potential there as that, I guess, understanding really can, you know, if it generalizes among the service sector, right?
Right.
So, one thing to point out, I think that it's worth bringing up now is that, you know, what we talk a lot about the way the tech industry has shaped the Bay Area economy. And this goes a little bit to your question about this, you know, service economy. It's very interesting to find out that that the tech industry, we talk about, you know, when there's a big industry in a geographical area, there's sort of a multiplier effect on sort of ancillary employment that sprouts up around it. That's not directly that industry, but somehow just a sort of spillover. And the tech industry has a multiplier effect, if that's the right term for it, three times greater than say than like traditional like manufacturing. So for example, for every tech job that's created, there's five service sector jobs that get created. So that's pretty amazing. It tells you something about the work that people are doing in the Bay Area economy. And the fact that it's become sort of a crisis to the capitalists that they cannot find enough people to fill these service jobs, tells us something about maybe an area that we might want to take a little more seriously.
Well, that's a really good insight. You know, one other example I can think from California, I don't know if this exactly fits in, but I know in Fresno, there's a potential, or maybe it's settled by now, a teacher strike, and they're offering subs $500 to come in and essentially break the strike. And I've heard there's people like from as far away as LA coming out.
Oh, boo.
Well, that's pretty,
let's just have it in the record, fuck scabs.
And that's really interesting because in 2006, when the Oakland teachers threatened to go on strike, they were only paying the scabs $300 a day.
Oh, wow.
Which
oh, wow.
means the labor shortage is that much more intensified.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in Fresno, where there's a large population around. But
yeah.
And let me just point out, it's not only here in the Bay Area, but it's every place there's this cluster of tech, which is not just here, but there's, you know, they call it the Silicon Forest in Portland, Oregon. Down in Southern California, they call it Silicon Beach, which is kind of the media internet complex around Culver City and Santa Monica. They call it Silicon Alley in New York. They call it Silicon Hills in Austin, Texas. They call it Biotech Beach in San Diego, which is that kind of biotech spinoff of tech. So it's happening
That's
everywhere.
That's officially the worst name out of all of them, I have
yeah,
to say.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, and then there's businesses that have always been tech. They call it Research Triangle in North Carolina, or Route 128 outside of Boston. So it's, you know, all those places are hubs or clusters of this kind of development that are obviously having this kind of knock-on effect.
Right.
I mean, even cities like college towns that have a mild tech sector like Asheville, North Carolina, is having a labor shortage in the service industry for restaurants and bars and cafes.
I think the other thing that that we paid some attention to is six recent and from all appearances relatively easy victories of workers that work in the service sector directly connected to the tech companies. So for example, there's been this just, what's the word? Almost, it's not quite an avalanche. Okay. That's going too far, but you get a cascade maybe of recent organizing, successes among cafeteria workers on the tech campuses, among drivers of the tech shuttles. I like to point out how surprised I was to hear about these organizing successes that were actually organized by the Teamsters of all unions. I mean, that's not known as some dynamic organizing union, and yet largely because of the shortage, it's been possible for these traditional unions, right, to win these victories with greater ease than what I think we've come to expect, which is usually long, drawn out, just wars of attrition with the employer. We're starting to hear about these successes in these places, even using fairly kind of staid and traditional methods of organizing, right? So that tells us something too, that there's a lot to be done here, that a lot of, I guess, kind of latent potential here for class struggle.
We're going to circle back and talk a little more about the gig economy in a second, but I wanted to kind of touch on Trump. And can we speak a little bit to both Trumpism and so-called, quote, economic nationalism that's been talked about by Bannon? You brought up this a little bit ago, but is Trumpism itself a departure from neoliberalism? And moreover, economically speaking, you know, 1 year into Trump, what have we seen? What have they done? Obviously, the tax bill is in some process of being passed, but just kind of curious your analysis.
Yeah, not much. I mean, he had all those plans and not many of them have come to fruition. But I think that's a good question. Is this the end of neoliberalism? Well, based on his own claims and based on what he spoke to his base, it was. I mean, he told a lot of people in deindustrialized parts of the United States what they wanted to hear, which was jobs. And with people like Bannon, part of that was a form of economic nationalism, which would be to rebuild the manufacturing center. Well, that isn't going to happen, but there seems to be in the works some kind of new protectionism. And how far that goes is a really good question. But it would be things like renegotiating NAFTA or just junking NAFTA, tanking the TPP and things like that. But it goes back to maybe some earlier traditions. Is like from the beginning of the United States, like Alexander Hamilton, his initial economic plans were based on tariffs. And at the beginning of the country, 100% of the government funding was based on tariffs. And that lasted until the Civil War. And then from the Civil War until World War I, 2/3 of the government was funded by tariffs. And then from World War I to World War II is about 1/3 of the government was funded by tariffs. And today, under neoliberalism, tariffs are gone. But to have that protectionist barrier to be able to allow any kind of like reinvestment in any kind of manufacturing would require new tariffs. But they couldn't be piecemeal, because if they had a tariff against China, manufacturers would go to Vietnam or Bangladesh. So what Trump has to do is it has to be all or nothing. He has to create a new regime of tariffs and protectionism or nothing. And it's yet to be seen how far he can do it, because there's a lot of people in the ruling class who are globalists, who build, you know, factories or maintain supply chains to bring goods from places like Bangladesh and China. In particular, the one that really kind of created it all is Walmart. And is Trump willing to go against these global players who source their materials all over the world, which is a lot of the corporate sector that produce hard goods? And that's a question that's yet to be answered. And so, to be honest, I don't know. And I don't know how far Trump will get through with that stuff, because there's too much also weight on him from just traditional Republicans who are invested in the traditional ruling class that have interests all over the world.
I mean, it is, I think in terms of the just sort of red meat to the base style politicking that comes up around the anti-immigrant stuff, you know, that stuff definitely serves, to the extent that it all, you know, kind of translates into more severe anti-immigrant policies, especially, that stuff definitely is an attack on on workers' power, right? I mean, to state the obvious, but it's also the more vulnerable you feel to being deported, the more unlikely you are to, you know, resist your employer, right? That's not, I want to make it very clear that, you know, we tend to be rather optimistic about the potential of class war. It's not to say that people can't overcome and find ways to, you know, sort of insulate against those risks, but those risks really are real. And to the extent that, like, the Trump administration is ramping that up, that serves to as a kind of counterpoint to the kind of class power that we see the potential of building.
And we're going to talk about kind of how automation kind of fits into that fairy tale of economic nationalism a little bit. But first, we wanted to turn towards, you know, you're doing this work around logistics and flows of capital, energy, et cetera. We want to ask you about the growth within the U.S. of the, quote, gig economy. Reports now place U.S. workers working more and more in the service sector, and we talked a little bit about this before. But with many people now existing in a weird gray area between unemployment and bouncing from job to job via Craigslist or doing something like driving for Lyft or trimming weed, what does the growth of the gig economy mean for the future of class warfare?
Another good question. And I think the full effects haven't been felt yet. Various statistics say that the gig economy, this is a really conservative estimate, but maybe only 1 or 2% of the workforce right now. And we live in San Francisco. We see it every day. I mean, I see the streets crowded, traffic jams caused by Uber and Lyft. I live in an apartment building. The lobby's filled with deliveries of everything from Blue Apron and all those pre-assembled food things to everybody gets stuff from Amazon and all the other delivery providers. But right now, it's not yet taken off. I mean, there's an amazing statistic is the United States still, for all our domestic needs, 85% of the things are manufactured in the United States, which is really phenomenal. It seems almost counterintuitive with all the goods flowing in, especially like garments and electronics. But that includes everything that we need in our daily lives, from food to construction materials to the plumbing and maintenance things. And the global average for that kind of internal markets is 72%. So the U.S., like Japan and Germany and some of the other more established industrial economies, we still make a lot of stuff here. So the gig economy is just fits into that. It's just an addition to that. And it's really the jury's out. I mean, it's growing. It's transforming work relations. The pay's really awful. I have some friends who work for both Uber and Lyft, and sometimes they say it's when they average it out over a year, it's maybe, you know, minimum wage. And a more remarkable fact is the turnover annually is 97%. And that's phenomenal. That means somebody who's driving somebody today in Uber a year from now probably isn't going to be driving that car.
Right.
So it's kind of a moving target. It's growing. It's just begun. It really began maybe around 10 years ago when the iPhone came out and all these app-based ways were devised to sell more things or to recompose the working class, you know, and you could count like Uber and all the labor stuff and then all the sales stuff like Airbnb. And in between more, you know, eBay is like, you know, a market, but then again to the labor stuff, the TaskRabbits is, you know, increasing. I guess we have to really look more carefully at the statistics. I think a lot of this is working an extra job.
Right.
Maybe moonlighting, we used to call it. And because they can't make ends meet, because they are struggling with what existing job they have, they take on these extra jobs just to try and keep their heads above water.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's not that we, you know, love the gig economy or anything like that. I don't want this to get confused. But to the extent locally here that, that it's contributing to the labor shortage in these traditional service sector jobs. Well, that's something in our favor, right? If we're gonna fight from that sector, right? From the service sector. So it's short term, but it does. Anything that adds to the shortage of labor is something in our column, right?
Right. Well, let's turn now towards automation. At the end of the year, companies are expecting to, which is now. Companies are saying they expect to start having self-driving trucks on the road, for example, And I know Walmart is now having robots do things like scan shelves and stuff like that. With the rise of automation taking more and more jobs, we ask, will we see action against this? And also, what will the effects be on working class people?
Well, I mean, I want to go back to how we introduced ourselves. We're against jobs, right? We're against work. So, and the reason why I say that is because, you know, I mean, you know, if you could make a robot to do all the crappy work that nobody wants to do, and so that we could all, you know, do the things that we love and, you know, take care of each other and build things and make art and, you know, feed each other and all that stuff, like, fantastic. The problem is who owns the robots, right? Who is it? Is a robot operating within capitalism to create profit for the boss and a miseration for the rest of us? You know, I mean, I guess that's the way that I would look at automation generally, but, you know, to get more specific, I'll let Hieronymus speak to it.
Well, you know, you brought up the point that it's not a matter of if, but when. And I think it's going to go into the logistics sector. I think trucks, like, you know, the new Tesla truck is just going to be put on. They're probably going to find designated highways. The proposal right now is the 710 freeway in Los Angeles, because it goes from the port and it goes to a lot of the logistics centers and rail yards near downtown Los Angeles. And that'd be a perfect place. It's along the San Gabriel River. And they can make designated lanes and they could make a trial there, and it would actually be a sell to people because it'd be electric trucks and non-polluting, and it would go along a right of way that doesn't impede on other traffic if they could get away with building that. And it would go to the busiest gateway for cargo, mostly by container coming to the United States. LA Long Beach take in 43% of the containers that come into the United States. So that'd be like a trial place. They're already proposing, you know, running a highway exclusively for these autonomous trucks. But it's going to drive more people out of the work process. You know, there's already proposals for autonomous trains, autonomous ships, and, you know, drones are one aspect of that. And it's a, you know, a question like that we have to really put our heads to is how can we organize against it? Because, of course, we don't want to, you know, we're not out to save jobs. We're out to transform the world.
Right.
And as Huli said, is like the question is who controls it?
Yeah.
Right. I totally agree. I guess to reframe it, I think the question is, it's like, obviously, to me, this seems like the natural extension of like kind of the gig economy or people becoming more and more precarious. It's like, well, a year ago you had a steady job. Now you drive for Lyft. Well, now a robot does that.
So, right.
So then the question is, what happens to you? And obviously in this society, the people that are excluded from the economy are pushed more and more to the margins and then, you know, repressed in some way or thrown in prison where they're forced to work in a different venue.
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, that's a big question. Like, what happens to human communities that were kind of manufactured before to engage in a specific kind of work, and then all of a sudden that work is totally gone? And obviously we see that in many communities now. I mean, you're in the Bay Area, so there's obviously whole neighborhoods of people that used to work, you know, in certain industries, and now they're either placed out of those industries or those industries are gone, and then the whole community has changed.
Yeah, it's not good. I mean, it leads to people, it leads to human misery, right? And that displacement. I think it's also worth thinking about where we see pushes for automation. They tend to, you know, kind of, you know, I think it's clear, like, logistics, you know, they're really, really pushing towards automation, partially to reduce costs, but also intentionally to sort of undercut this, you know, natural kind of problem of class struggle, right? Which is, you know, workers in ports and warehouses and in factories, you know, will fight against their conditions, right? And robots won't, right? The same thing came up when, you know, in the discussions about raising the wages of fast food workers, that the, you know, the bosses talked about, you know, automating the process of fast food. So it's a response from capitalists to eliminate problems, and in other words, the human problem of class struggle,
Right.
So that's going to be something that we're going to confront over and over and over again. And again, we have to think beyond how do we save jobs and more towards how do we gain control of this stuff, right?
Right. Also, I think another question is like, will we see struggles break out over automation? Like, I think some people have asked, will we see a return of the Luddites or something like that that don't want these robots, you know, doing these jobs?
Right. I don't know. I think it's difficult for me to endorse. You know, it's difficult for me to endorse the idea that we should be fighting for jobs, you know?
Well, you know, again, it's the question, like, you know, the age-old question of building or fighting for a classless society is to expropriate the expropriators. Is, you know, if we could seize control, you know, the dream, the end goal is we're probably not going to have all this robotic stuff. We're probably going to have some automation that will make our lives more rich. But the goal isn't to, you know, automate everything in the world, because that's a tendency of capital, is just to kind of, you know, intensify, using a Marxian term, the organic composition of capital, because machines don't fight back. They don't argue. They work overtime without question. But then capital pushes itself to this brink. It dumps too much investment into these machines, and then it doesn't have enough surplus value to extract out and have value to, you know, accumulate capital. So it is pushing it towards the brink of crisis, but at the same time, at our expense, at the immiseration of the working class. So it's a good question of how do we fight back? And I really don't have any answers except the end goal. And also, you know, workers sometimes protect the standard of living they got. Right now it's shit, but to fight for more given the conditions we have now. And it's a thorny question, which there's no easy answer.
Well, with all that in mind, let's now talk about your work mapping capital flows. And can you explain the thinking behind this, the thinking behind looking at global supply chains and why it is important?
Okay. You know, it kind of goes back to neoliberalism, the question earlier. And by like 1980, with, you know, China entering the world market as far as being able to produce goods for export and the deregulation that happened to almost everything, especially in advanced countries, and Reagan and Thatcher just attacking working class positions of strength. You know, the first thing Reagan did really when he came to power was he fired 11,000 air traffic controllers in the UK. Thatcher went after the miners union, which had traditionally been militant, and they just kind of attacked and gutted them. So our idea is the world has been reconformed. The working class has been spread throughout the world because of those destructions of previous centers of workers' power. We really, really draw on this one theorist named Beverly Silver, because she talks about how those are all fixes for capital. They're spatial fixes if they just relocate, if you build a factory in Shenzhen, China, to assemble iPhones. But they're also technological fixes, back to the automation question. Capital always tries to find a way out to disempower workers. So part of understanding how all that's linked together on the global scale is part of our project. But we never lose sight that all the nodes in the global supply chains are operated by workers. And it's a class system, and it's a way to try and spread out the ability of capital to accumulate and make profits, but to our expense. And so our idea is we have to trace the supply chains wherever they're going and wherever they're bringing stuff from and wherever they're taking stuff to. And all of us are part of it because we consume, and, you know, some of us work in some ways where the movement of goods and the movement of capital are, you know, integral to that process. So part of our project is looking at those flows, but even more importantly, with our current part of our project, the Global Supply Chain Research Group, is to create worker-to-worker network along those supply chains. So we've focused on industries of people we know and friends we have and comrades we have in industries like railroads. And we know some longshore workers, and we know maritime workers, and we know a lot of port truckers who've been, they're probably the most victimized by the neoliberal precarious, you know, there's this legal fiction that they're independent contractors, even though they work for brokers who tell them where to work. It's kind of what enabled the Uber system, where Uber drivers are employers, but they're operating under this legal fiction that they're independent contractors, they're their own business people, which is absolute bullshit. So part of our project is to see how those linkages could be made stronger. And as part of that, we've been doing some conferences, we've been doing workshops, and one of them, and we call it our Supply Chain Workers Inquiry. And we've done it for various groups, actually around the world. We started here in the Bay Area. One of the most successful ones we did was in 2015. We went to Richmond, California, and we tried to bring together. It was really an interesting time because at that time, there was a United Steelworkers strike that represented refinery workers who struck, I think, at 11 different facilities across the United States, including the Valero refinery in Martinez. Well, we had this conference in Richmond, but the premise was built on railroad safety. And the reason we did that is because in 2013, there was that horrendous accident in Lac Mégantic in Canada, where a runaway train killed 47 people. And all those oil trains from all the fracked shale going across the country were creating these incredible hazards. And part of the conference was to bring together railroad workers, communities that were affected, and by a mere stroke of luck, the refinery workers who were on strike. So at that Richmond conference, we had 24 railroad workers, 9 refinery workers, including 4 who jumped in a car and drove up from Carson, which is near the port of Long Beach in Southern California. And we had a dialogue, and we had our group, the Supply Chain Research Group, actually created this workers' inquiry idea of, like, if that strike could be spread, how could railroad workers and truckers and refinery workers and everyone else along the energy supply chain somehow act in solidarity, either covertly or overtly, because some sectors are unionized, some are not, some are restricted, some have different rules. Railroad workers operate under the Railroad Labor Act that actually allows some kind of secondary boycotts, which is a more complex, thorny thing. But just the thought experiment of seeing how workers could see that they were part of the same integral production process, even for us, was eye-opening, because when the workers started talking, they all had the same issues. They were poor training, really shitty safety protocol.
Work speed ups,
irregular hours, shift changes. Actually at the conference in Richmond, a person who worked at a power plant said, I sometimes have to work graveyard, and then a week later I'm working the day shift, and then a couple weeks later I'm working the swing shift, and my sleep cycles never get caught up. Somebody made the germane point that some of the most horrendous industrial accidents happen in those graveyard shifts, like the Exxon Valdez that crashed in Alaska, the Three Mile Island meltdown, Chernobyl, they all happen in the middle of the night. And when workers are fatigued, they can't really do these safe operations. But all of our health and safety is dependent on having a safe process. But the corporations that run these industries, you know, cut corners, they cheat on safety equipment and safety protocol, and it's us and the workers who face the greatest risks. And if you take trains hauling things like, say, dock and shale from the Dakotas, is if the train goes off the track, the first person who gets fried are the people working in the locomotive, the engineer and the conductor. And so what's been interesting to us is to try to bring solidarity all through that production process.
So I think a lot of people thinking about mapping global supply chains and all that, looking at logistics, they would ask, where are the pressure points within capitalism? Or in other words, where is it the weakest?
Well, I mean, we definitely definitely think about that. I think it's important to have kind of an analysis of what adds to relative strength and weakness, right? My comrade alluded to looking at, using the analysis that Beverly Silver uses in her work has been helpful for us to think about areas of strength and weakness and, you know, in this area. Did you want to jump in on that?
Well, you know, if you look at the class composition of the supply chains, we do look at who works where. And,
right.
And by just analyzing that, you know, we again, like what we said before, as you analyze this, what is the numeric strain? You know, say, for example, let me just give you an example. So a container ship comes into, say, LA Long Beach, it's the biggest portal, and across the United States, they're maritime workers. There's actually 28,000 of them working tugboats and harbor pilots. And then when the ship hits the docks and it gets unloaded, there's 60,000 longshore workers. And when the containers get taken off the ship and then get shipped to either a distribution center or a warehouse or to the market, you know, there's 60,000 port truckers. And then a lot of stuff, especially if it goes beyond 500 miles from a port, gets taken by train. There's 165,000 railroad workers. But the biggest sector is over-the-road truckers. There's 850,000 truckers. There's a growing sector of warehouse workers. There's at least 2 million right now, and that's growing because Amazon keeps building new warehouses for the fulfillment centers, and everyone else is trying to catch up, especially old school, you know, or more, not as old school, but Walmart doesn't want to miss out, so they have a whole online presence. And then there's the last mile, and that's like FedEx or UPS, or now more independent contractors driving their cars, bringing the goods to your house, especially if the deal's about same-day delivery or two-hour delivery. And then there's another sector about planners, and they plan all this stuff. So by knowing who works where and doing these kind of investigative, not only workshops, but just inquiries, we can help workers find their own strengths. And there are a lot of them. And again, like your question is germane, is because where is the vulnerability? Well, sometimes the vulnerability is when something moves from one work sector to another. And if workers could say, okay, my contract says I could honor a secondary boycott, those workers refuse to move a hot cargo, that stuff can sit in a warehouse, on the docks, on the back of a truck. And so that's where we see the strength being, is the agency of working class people knowing, they know from the inside how the system works. We're learning from them mostly, but there is a slogan, and the slogan is that not all of those work sectors that I just delineated would have to go on strike or struggle or do a solidarity action, just a couple of them at the most strategic vulnerable places. Now, obviously, that's when things come to their narrowest choke point, which is often ports. And going back to Beverly Silver, she studied strikes across the world over the last 150 years. And one of the work sectors that has the longest history of strikes have been longshore workers, because they know that vulnerability. They know if they don't move it off the ship, their skills are pretty unique. And if they don't work, nobody else come right now knows how to come and work the crane. Mm-hmm. But that also begs the question of automation. And that's another topic. But the way to de-skill them is what they've done at ports like Rotterdam, where now they actually have cranes that are operated by robotics and infrared cameras. And they were put on these carts that haul the containers across the port that don't have drivers, that have dining systems under the pavement. And so capital's approach to try and weaken the strength of workers in those particular sectors is to automate. Mm-hmm. So it's a moving target. And it's also a moving target in the sense of, if workers have agitation at a single port, capital will just divert the cargo and go to another port. Like during Occupy, if we block Oakland, they're going to go to LA, Long Beach, Tacoma. They're going to go to Vancouver, British Columbia. They're going to find an alternative route. And we have to think likewise. We have to be able to see, if they're going to divert, how can we spread that solidarity to all the ports that might be affected?
Right. I mean, I think that it's worth thinking about what capital does to prepare itself for disruption, right? And it doesn't sit around waiting to get disrupted and then freak out. It has contingency plans, right? So, for example, you know, any one of these Walmart or Apple or whomever isn't dependent on one little factory somewhere creating one little, you know, piece of equipment. They have no doubt where they get their supplies from, so that if one is shut down because the workers go on strike, it won't, you know, just automatically shut down production of the phone or the gadget or whatever, right? So again, you know, it really comes down to being really intentional in our thinking about spreading and amplifying solidarity up and down supply chains, and not overlooking how capital has already thought through its contingency plans. We have to take those into account.
Can we talk about some examples of workers, communities, putting these kinds of ideas and ethics into practice and struggle?
Yeah.
An inspired one. I'm going to start with the specific, the most strength in action, and then I'm broadening out to the general. But in 2006, when Sensenbrenner in Congress tried to introduce a bill called 4437, House Bill 4437, which was the Sensenbrenner Act, which was going to not only make undocumented workers illegal, or you criminalize them, anyone who provided any aid to them, it could be a church, a worker center, it could be an ESL class, those people were violators of a misdemeanor. It was crazy. And it was just part of this agenda that's age old, you know, that Trump's ramping up, but it's just attack on immigrants. And in 2006, immigrants, with some buildup, they planned for it, and it was centered in cities like Los Angeles and Houston and really Boston and Chicago, but spread through thousands of cities across the United States. It was the 2006 May Day general strike. Now, I said I was going to talk about the particular strength. That was at the port of L.A. Long Beach. At the time, there was 16,500 truckers. Probably 95% of them were Latino, and they, being immigrants, went out on strike, and they shut down the busiest port complex in the Western Hemisphere by a factor of about 95% by just not working. So that's kind of immigrants fighting for class power, fighting at a vulnerable choke point in the supply chain, and fighting against these racist anti-immigrant laws, and they forced Congress to back down. To us, that's one inspiring example.
We'd like to see that go further than just shutting down a bill in Congress, of course, but it is a really good example of what can happen, and it might give some explanation of our source of optimism. That was the biggest work stoppage in U.S. history.
Some people say 5 to 8 million workers didn't work for May Day, and a lot of those Latinos had come from countries where May Day was International Workers' Day, and it was, you know, of the radical tradition that goes back to where it was founded, which is Haymarket. So kind of brought it full circle in the tradition of the Haymarket martyrs through the conduit of Latin America and immigrants coming back here to the United States. They were acting out on that radical impulse, which is inspiring, and that's kind of the actions we'd like to see.
I think one of the things that strikes me is that since 2006, May Day on 2006, we haven't seen that replicated on that scale. But I believe that it's not impossible to do, but I believe that it does serve as something that we can kind of imagine, that it's happened not that long ago. 11 years isn't very long. It can certainly happen again. It certainly took a tremendous amount of coordination and planning between workers. And I also want to point out something that's important to us about that. By far, the majority of those workers who went out on strike that day didn't belong to traditional organized unions, right? What they did was they acted in the spirit of solidarity with one another, right? Which is really what's important here, whether or not you actually have a traditional, you belong to a traditional labor institution or not. In some ways, when you don't, you have greater latitude to take action, right? Without being kind of held back by these actually pretty effective labor laws that, you know, prevent people from walking out well under the terms of a contract. So, we find it really inspiring that workers who were not in traditional unions were thinking about ways to withhold their labor as a way to fight capital, fight these really awful conditions. So that's a big example for us.
And just to give you kind of another sequence, you know, it was a worldwide sequence. I would just say maybe one of the sparks was the food riots about grain speculation in 2008 that actually had major riots in 33 countries across the world. A really hit country that really took off, because there have been previous attempts of like messing with the food supply, was Egypt. But Egypt, already back to around 2005, had a wave of strikes in the textile sector. They have a huge complex north of Cairo called Muhalla al-Kubra. And there have been strikes there that really started to kind of weaken the Mubarak regime. By the time the food riots happened, he was starting to become discredited. By the time that it reached a saturation point in 2011, is the Arab Spring really spread around the world. And it really gave inspiration, because the people in Egypt, particularly who seized Tahrir Square in Cairo, were really, like the quotes when they were interviewed were saying, "We're no longer afraid. We were under this despot, a dictatorship." And here they were fighting back, but then it rippled across North Africa, it rippled around the world, and then it quickly hit its limitations. But here in North America, some inspiration for the resistance to Scott Walker, the Republican, the Tea Party candidate getting elected in Wisconsin, was his first thing, his first act as the governor was Article 10 to just completely gut public sector unions in Wisconsin. Within a week of that, there was an occupation of the Capitol. 100,000 people on the weekends were occupying the state capitol in Wisconsin. But more importantly, within a week, 38% of the schools in Wisconsin were shut. And it wasn't always teachers striking or calling in sick. A lot of the walkouts were led by students. But it became a rolling wildcat wave of strikes that shut down the Wisconsin economy and again reached its limitation pretty quick. Mm-hmm. But then I think we have to say that the Occupy came out of the same spirit. And I think Occupy might be a little too much. It's another subject, maybe for another time. But the high point here for us would be the port action on November 2nd, where Occupy Oakland occupied the port of Oakland. And again, I think that's beyond the pale of this conversation, but we could see this phase of struggle centered on workers resisting work, refusing their labor, trying to promote and propel their struggle forward.
You know, I think a lot of people thinking about this, thinking about, blockades of flows of capital and resources, will be thinking about the recent action that took place in Olympia, Washington, against the fracking sands at the Port of Olympia. And I'm just curious, when we think about climate change, and we think about, mapping flows of capital and logistic capital. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, is there a correlation, you think, between thinking about fighting climate change and the kind of work that you all are doing?
Oh yeah. I mean, definitely being able to look at where things are flowing and where they're flowing from, and all of that stuff is going to be a useful tool in thinking about areas to that are most vulnerable and most most amenable to our ability to fight back. I do want to say something that occurs to us is that we often, as we talked about earlier, talking about really looking at our work in terms of developing some kind of useful tool that people who work in various parts of, in various sectors or parts of the supply chains or in the service sector or whatever, useful tools that could be created to amplify their efforts, right? And I think that one of the things that happens around unfortunately, and this is really kind of an age-old problem now, when there's resistance around climate change, whether it's blocking an oil pipeline or blocking fracking equipment, that we always get to this point where there's this tension between the people who are standing in front of the progress of a pipeline or a train, And the people that are into their wages in that industry, right? And we do have to think about that. I guess I would, maybe this is a little bit simplistic, but I believe it might be worth thinking about how we can incorporate into those types of blockade actions a central demand that, because you're talking about hourly workers who don't get paid if they don't work, if their jobs shut down for the day, they don't get paid, then maybe trying to work more into a central sort of demand or piece of the fight that for, every day, every hour that we shut down a pipeline or a railroad or whatever, that the bosses pay those workers, something along those lines or along that spirit of making sure that when we do this with the highest sense of class solidarity. But, at Standing Rock, it was really unfortunate to see this really awful reactionary union rhetoric coming from the laborers union that was like against the blockade, right? Against the Standing Rock fight, right? And that was really disgusting to see. But it was based on this idea that these working people who work in the pipeline industry were losing wages and pay. And so, you know, there was just this opening for that kind of divisive rhetoric. And it sickens me that it came from a labor union. But, you know, unfortunately, that's not as not that great a surprise. But I think that we can, as radicals, really kind of think of ways to circumvent that kind of bullshit from really taking root.
And I have an example from kind of a little far afield. But in the mid-60s, in Italy, the Europe's biggest petrochemical complex was at a place called Porto Marghera. And they were influenced by the kind of the operismo. Some of the Italian radicals started doing workers' inquiry in this petrochemical complex, and they came up with a simple solution. If it damages human life and they were getting these toxins in their bodies, and as the waste were being put in the bay nearby, the Bay of Veneto, which is just in the mainland from Venice, is it should be shut down. And not only should it be shut down, management should pay to remediate not only the damage to the environment, but to the workers' medical care. And if it can't be made safe for human life or the life of the planet, it should be shut down, with the demand that management or the state or a combination of both should give workers a means of subsistence, which means their wages should continue to be paid until they could readjust. It was the same demand that happened here in the States. The late Tony Mazzocchi had the same idea. He was one of the leaders of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union, made famous with the Karen Silkwood case. He had the same demand. If it's unhealthy, shut it down and give workers a means of subsistence till they find something else. But I think that idea could be brought as if pipeline protesters say, we are in solidarity with the workers who are being toxified by these industries. And if they work together, we would be all that much stronger. And not only that, the workers within those industries could share secrets about how to shut it down and how to monkey wrench it and how to stop the flow of energy commodities.
All right. Are you all ready to take some questions from the internet?
Yeah,
sure.
So this is from our Twitter account. First person says, any ideas on how to build community syndicalism, and they're referring to like solidarity networks, in the U.S.? How can an emphasis on logistics help us in the class struggle and the struggle against global ecocide?
I think we just kind of answered that. I think that the knowledge, and I think workers and, you know, protesters against these horrendous things that are despoiling the environment get together. When we did the conference in Richmond, one of the railroad workers said his demand is simple, keep it in the ground. Now, if that's the agenda that we all could agree on, how could we fight together? And that's a question of meeting together and having workers and people like the First Nations that are affected fight together and find that overlap and meet together and strategize.
Any thoughts about how this could link with things like what Seattle Solidarity Network is doing?
I know a little bit about what they're doing, and I've read some stuff, and it's really admirable. I just don't feel like I know enough.
In many ways, they're applying, I think, this kind of logic to, you know, a smaller level, looking at the ways in which they could put pressure on bosses and landlords,
right,
you know, on a community level. So I think that kind of applies. The next question is, what is your question on the failure of G20 protesters blocking the Hamburg Harbor? How could a successful blockade, even symbolic, have been achieved on that day?
Oh, boy. I didn't read up on that.
It says, i.e., how can a movement such as IL/No G20 integrate workers?
I mean, again, I think that the question of, I mean, first off, I just come from the position of that, you know, if we're dependent on a wage to survive and, you know, we don't own the means of production, we're all workers, whether we work in that particular sector or not is another question, right? And so I look at it so much more like, you know, if I don't work in that sector, in the logistics sector, what is my relationship to those workers who do work in that sector? And so that, you know, personally, I don't know if I would feel particularly comfortable taking the position that, you know, I personally would not feel that it was effective or appropriate to engage in a blockade of something that where the people who work in that port or railroad or whatever weren't part of the planning and coordination of that activity, right? So I don't know enough about the Hamburg blockade. But I just say as a general rule, my inclination is that, like, if we're going to be talking about blockading, you know, let's be optimistic that there's a way to do it on the basis of class solidarity with the people who work in, you know, in that particular workplace, right? So that's my best answer. I just don't know enough about what happened in Hamburg to make any really informed.
And I'd also say just the question is, you know, to all of us is how can we go from the symbolic to the really materially effective? And that would be analyzing what the conditions are, and we don't know, so we can't really answer.
Right.
Next question. Here in Seattle, the port is forcing drivers to buy themselves new, quote, greener trucks by a certain date or face being barred from getting work. I'd like to hear their thoughts on that and how they think workers can organize against
that. That happened in around the Port of Oakland recently, too. And, you know, this goes to the question that came up earlier, where a lot of these truckers are supposedly considered independent contractors, right? So, you know, the cost gets externalized onto them, right? The costs of industry get externalized onto them. So that's kind of the that's a real attack. That's a real problem.
It's a good question. It's happened in a lot of the ports on the West Coast. In L.A. Long Beach, they did the same thing, and they offered subsidies and including grants. And some truckers actually were able to apply for the grants and actually got their truck paid for, and it was a green truck. That was a good deal, but it's not ideal. I mean, we don't want to, you know, the capitalists to provide our means of production. So it's a kind of a demand at all the ports on the West Coast, because trucks idling, which is the way they externalize the inefficiencies of the systems onto the truckers, and if they're burning diesel, it just causes immense population pollution problems. Port of Oakland, I think a third of the kids who were born within the port area are, you know, in their infancy developed asthma. So it's a mixed thing. Is if we could get the state or the capitalists to pay for green trucks, that's great. But if they're forcing drivers to buy them themselves, we should fight back and force the state to do what they've done in places like LA Long Beach and give grants for the truckers to buy these green trucks.
Awesome. Well, just to close this out, anything else that you want to say? Anything else we didn't get a chance to go over? And also for people that are really fascinated by this stuff and want to learn more, what's the next step? What else can they investigate? Where can they go to get more information?
Well, we have a blog. We maintain our own blog on LibCom. It's called Supply Chain Research. If somebody just does an internet search, they could come up with it, and they'll find information about what we've done, our workshops, report backs of, you know, the different, we've done energy supply chain workshops. We actually, some of us went to China and met some workers there and talked about supply chains and solidarity across oceans and internationalism. So you see a lot of the reports of the stuff we've done there. But we've also, if we could make plugs for books, people should read Beverly Silver's Forces of Labor. We're really big advocates of Joe Byrne's book, Reviving the Strike.
Yeah. Also, read the capitalist press, right? It's interesting to see how they speak to one another about the threats that they see. because that we can read between the lines on that stuff and get some insight into what, you know, areas where we may have a greater potential for resistance.
Yeah, to answer the question is, like, where are the greatest vulnerabilities of supply chains or even capitalist production chains? Often I go to my public library and read the Wall Street Journal and business magazines, because if the capitalists talk about the threats, they are a threat to their profitability. And like my comrade said, reading between the lines is a good way to find out what the capitalists are afraid of. But I think even the best is maybe this site. It's going down. It's a wonderful resource.
Yeah.
I encourage everybody to keep following and contributing to.
Yeah, I can't say enough good about your site. You guys are doing really great work.
Thanks so much for coming on. You know, we'll have links to your blog on LibCom. And anything else in parting that you want to say that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
Well, you want to thank you for giving us a chance to talk to people today. And then, you know, I guess I would just hope that, you know, that people, you know, sort of incorporate a bit of optimism. It's hard to do that in these times, I guess, but you know, when we start looking at where we could potentially really concentrate our power, there is some ray of hope here. So I would want to see us coming out of this long period where I think that we've been sort of beset by a sense of defeatism and almost to the point of actually romanticizing defeat. I want to see us move away from that in the opposite direction to, you know, having some optimism and some confidence in our power together.
Mm-hmm. And I think, as you said, you know, there's no more time to debate and do symbolic actions. It's been class war since the beginning of capitalism, and we are left with the alternative of the two kind of quotes is fight or be sore, socialism or barbarism.
But a thief on a time loan, 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the fucking bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, lie. Bury me with my MP3s, write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs for every bridge that ain't been burned, for every cop car that ain't been turned. I'm rich off the land, rich cause I learned that money's just a hologram. It's made of paper and the shit don't burn. Violent dreams keep me in a cold sweat. There'll be peace on earth when we all dead. You think it's fame, but we know it's all debt. We all the same to a bounce check. Until then, you know I ain't scared. I know life ain't fair. Got one hand in the dirt, the other hand's a middle finger sticking in the air, pointing at a drone like, yeah, I see you, player. Screaming, I don't give a fuck like I'm Dick Cheney. Some of my old fans wanna say I sound like Kanye, but I'd rather kill myself so I'd burn the office down and put the records out myself. I don't pay for play, I'd rather pay for a grave with an HD screen if I'm fucking playing. I'm playing with the atom, if I'm playing with the atom, then you can call me Saddam. Nobody double, since I don't believe in change, I'm just making trouble. The white man still the devil be, but the devil just ain't what it used to be. If God's a cop, I'm a cop killer. If property is theft, I'm a bank robber. A lot of cats rap like a car commercial, so I put it in a song and put it on my wanted poster. Yeah, stole your style, cause I don't give a fuck. Rather rap a Molotov than write songs for the morgue.